Thank you, Prabhu. So nice to be with you after a long time. So we're going to try and cover chapters number 7 and 8 today, right? 7 and 8. Let's keep it open. Let's keep it as discussion. I'm sure you have many thoughts and questions. And this is really, really practical section of the Nectar of Devotion, which is all to do with the 64 items of devotional service. So we got a couple of hours. Ishan, you can tell me when to stop for the Maha. Mahaprasadam. Someone can let me know, otherwise we'll just go through. Yeah?
Can you put down the light on?
Sure. Okay, so we are... In this section is very interesting. We're discussing the science of devotion. In what sense would you say devotional service is a science?
Well, there's rules and process.
Right? Okay, there's a rules, there's a process.
There's an experiment.
So there's an experiment, there's something that you do.
There's a clear beginning, goal, process.
There's a process of getting there.
Yeah. Result.
There's a result. Yeah. What is the scientific method? The scientific method is essentially hypothesis, experiment, observation. And in spiritual life, there's a hypothesis, there's an experiment. This is the experiment we're going to learn about. And then there's an observation. There are things that will happen. And that's also described in the literatures. In what sense would you say bhakti is not a science?
It's not direct sense perception.
It's not direct sense perception? But what does Krishna say in the Gita? Raja Vidya Raja Guyam Pavitram Idamutamam Pratyaksha Avagamam Dharmyam is directly perceived. You can directly perceive the self by realization. What does Rupa Goswami say in Nectar of Devotion? Ata Shri Krishna Namadi Nabhavet Rayam Indriye. With your Indriya, you cannot, your blunt material senses, you cannot understand Krishna. But sevon mukhe hi jivado, when you do seva, when you do service, your senses become spiritualized and then you can perceive. So we actually say you can perceive Krishna by your senses, by spiritual senses. So would you say there's any aspect of bhakti that is not like a normal science? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like love, you have love, natural love.
It's to do with emotions, it's to do with feeling, which you can't necessarily measure in that way. Yeah? Does that mean you say the same thing?
Sometimes people might get different results in the same experiment.
Sometimes people experience do the experiment but get different results, but okay.
Yeah.
There's one element in the bhakti tradition that is not an induced factor. That is essential. Without it, won't work.
Relationship.
And that you have no control over.
Mercy.
Ah. So we say bhakti is a science, but at the same time, it's not that if you do A, B, C, D, and E, you will definitely get this. Because you can do A, B, C, D, and E, and then you have to wait for the mercy to come, and then you'll get the result. Whereas in science, it's just you do A, B, C, D, and E, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So in one sense, science, devotional service is a science, but in another sense, we say it's a higher dimensional science because it also includes grace and mercy. And therefore, it's not mechanical. It's not that Krishna has to reveal himself to you. It's not that you can control Krishna. That if I do this, Krishna has to come before me. No, it's up to Krishna. Therefore, when Mother Yashoda was trying to tie Krishna, it was two fingers too short. Mm. And what is that effort? This experiment, that you do your effort, but then you have to wait for the mercy, and then the science works. Yeah? So, So in our scriptures, you know, there are different books. For example, Bhagavatam, we can say, is an anthology of love. Because it gives you different stories, different devotees, different interactions between Krishna that show how devotion is, how love is so beautiful. So it's an anthology of stories of love. And then you have Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is like the science of love, which is what we're discussing now. And then you have books like Madhurya Kadambini, which are like a roadmap of love. So Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu will teach you how to awaken love, but the Madhurya Kadambini, what it will show you is what happens inside of you as this love begins to manifest. So can you see how within our tradition, at every stage, there is a guidance on how to actually develop this love. Therefore, it's considered to be the most advanced theology. And so, all of this is given to us by Rupa Goswami. You see, the Goswamis, they were incredible personalities. The Goswamis played many, many different roles in their life. Yeah? They were managers. They were managing and building temples. Not only that, they were leaders. They were leaders of community. They were spiritual leaders. Not just that, they were pujaris. Not just that, they were teachers. Not just that, they were also authors. And in terms of the books that they wrote many, many different types of books. They wrote commentaries. Does anyone know any of the commentaries that the Goswamis wrote? For example, Sanatana Goswami writes a commentary on the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam entitled Brihat Vaishnav Toshani. So they wrote commentaries on the Shastra. Not only that, they wrote their own philosophical books. For example, Jiva Goswami, he is known as the greatest scholar of all time in India. And he wrote something called the Satsandarbhas, which are like the complete philosophy of Gaudiya Vaishnavism from Sambandha Abhideya Prayojan, from beginning to middle to end. Not just that, they wrote poetry. Have you ever seen something called Chitra Kavitvani? You were on the PS retreat, you saw it, right? I did a presentation on that. You see Rupa Goswami, he writes something called picture poetry. And if you see this, it will blow your mind. He writes, like, for example, he writes a verse on rasa. You know what rasa is? Rasa means relationship, mellow, taste, exchange. But he writes a whole verse about rasa, and he only uses two syllables, ra and sa. And he writes a whole verse using two syllables. The two syllables are ra and sa, and the whole verse is about rasa. And it rhymes. And it gives you the deepest philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Not just that, he writes a verse with one syllable. I'll show you later. These were incredible people. Not just poetry, they write pastime books. Does anyone know any of the pastime books of the Goswamis?
Gopakumar.
Yeah, Gopakumar. Like say for example, Sanatana Goswami writes Brihat Bhagavatamrita about Gopakumar trying to find out which is the highest planet in the universe. Yeah, very good. Or for example, Raghunath Das Goswami, he writes a book, Mukta Charita. It's a story of how Krishna one day went to the gopis and he said, can you give me some pearls for my cows? Because he saw them stringing pearls. And they're like, we ain't giving you any pearls. What for your cows? These are expensive pearls, I'm not going to give it for your cows. And Krishna got angry and then he said, okay, well then I'll go and I'll plant my own pearls. So then Krishna took a pearl and he went to the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj and he planted a pearl. And they were laughing, they were like, pearls don't grow in the ground, they come at the bottom of the ocean. Krishna said, no, no, I'll plant the pearls. And he planted the pearls and then he watered the pearls with the milk of Raja's cows. And then the next morning, many trees of pearls came. So this whole story is given in a book called Mukta Charita by Raghunath Das Goswami. And not only that, they wrote handbooks. And handbooks on how to practice spiritual life, or how to learn certain things. So for example, Jiva Goswami writes a book, Harinamamrita Vyakarana. Learning Sanskrit grammar only from chanting Hari's names. The whole book is like chanting only Krishna's names, but you learn grammar from it at the same time. Amazing. And then he writes Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Yeah, it's a handbook. Yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm coming to. And then he writes a book like Nectar of Devotion, which is the science of devotion. So you see, these were incredible people, the Goswamis. They were... you should read about the Goswamis. They were amazing personalities. So here, what Rupa Goswami is doing is in the science of devotion. So far, he's said many things in the Nectar of Devotion. He's explained what are the effects of devotional service, or what is the definition of pure devotional service. He's talked about how devotional service goes through different stages. But now he's actually talking about how to practice devotional service. And he says there are 64 items. There are 64 items, and I think you already read that in chapter number 6. Those 64 items are listed. If you go to the morning program between 4:30 in the morning to 8:30, and you stay for the whole thing, you don't like crash out at 6:30 in the Bhakta house and then miss the rest of the program. If you stay for the whole thing, whole 4 hours, you know how many of these 64 items you do?
40.
I don't know myself. But it's a lot. It's something like 50. Like one day, maybe you guys can go through it one time. Decorate the body with tilak. You can't turn up without tilak, so you do that one. You can count it. I think it's about, I think you do about 50 plus. That's how powerful the morning program is. Just in case you think, well, I'm going, I don't know, what am I really getting out of it? Is anything happening? Of the 64 things that you need to do to awaken love, 50 of them you automatically do just by being in the morning program. You dance, you smell the flowers, you worship Tulsi, you hear Bhagavatam, you... so many things, yeah? You chant. Yeah, you touch, you know... Drink Charanamrit, you sing, everything, so many. Personal service to the deities, so many things you can do. Okay, so 64 items. So now what Rupa Goswami is doing is he's showing that, and then in the forthcoming chapters now, 4 or 5 chapters, he'll go through all of those different items of devotional service. And so I think basically what we're doing today is just going through them, isn't it really? Is there anything anyone wants to ask before I start getting into some of these practices?
I think the 64 things were covered in chapter 6.
You did 6. Yeah, they're just listed, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah, they're just listed in chapter number 6. And now from chapter number 7, we're going to start unpacking them. And kind of, and seeing how they kind of relate to our life. Yeah? Okay, so let's start doing that then. So, of the 64 items, it's said now that the first 3 are most,
you always find it.
They say something is most important, and then they're like, then there's 5 that are most important. We can say that these are essential. Yeah, let's say these are essential. The first 3 are essential. 64 items of how to render service to Krishna, but the first three are super, super important, because the first three all deal with the spiritual master. Unless one contacts a spiritual master, unless one develops a relationship with a spiritual master, unless one learns from a spiritual master, and unless one becomes trained and molded and receives the mercy of a spiritual master, they cannot access the other 61 items of devotional service. The spiritual master is like the gateway. Therefore, in the Sanskrit of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it said, Ado Guru Padashraya. Ado, in the beginning, Guru, the spiritual master, Pada, his feet, Ashraya, take shelter of. In the beginning of spiritual life, you must take the shelter of the lotus feet of the spiritual master, because the spiritual master is the one who is opening up the world of devotion. In these verses, therefore, this verse from the 11th canto is a very famous verse in Sanskrit. Tasmad gurum prapadyeta jigyasu shreya uttamam shabde pare chanishnatam brahmanyu pashamashrayam. One can find this verse. Prabhupada quoted it many, many times. This is an extremely important verse. It's explaining, if one is serious about spiritual realization, gurum prapadyeta, they must become initiated by a guru. And then Prabhupada in this section, I'm not going to read everything because otherwise we don't get time, but essentially Prabhupada is giving qualifications. Who is a spiritual master? Okay, you tell me I need to surrender. How do I know who's a spiritual master? And the easiest way to know who is a spiritual master, if you want to summarize it, is a spiritual master is one who knows the way, goes the way, and shows the way. A spiritual master knows the way to Krishna. Why? Because they have philosophical understanding. A spiritual master should know the Shastra. Not just that, a spiritual master should be able to answer questions and defeat arguments. If you don't know Shastra, you can't be a spiritual master. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Kiba Vipra, Kiba Nyashi, Shudra Keninoi. Doesn't matter, you can be a Brahmana, a Sudra, a man, a woman, black or white. Jai Krishna Tattva Veta. If you know the science of Krishna, say Guru Hoy, you should be considered a Guru. And Prabhupada made this point again and again. Sometimes people in India would criticize, how you made your Western disciples, sannyasis, made them gurus. Prabhupada said, Western, Eastern, doesn't matter. If they know the science of Krishna, they're guru. And how do you know the science of Krishna? You have to read Shastra. So the first thing is that a guru knows Shastra. If they don't know Shastra, they can't be guru. Not just that, but practical. They practice it in their life. They have the character. Here Prabhupada quotes, a spiritual master is not just someone who knows, but someone who lives it. In other words, Prabhupada quotes here that a spiritual master should be able to control the six urges. What are the six urges?
Speak.
Genitals.
Mind.
Belly.
Tongue.
Mind.
Tongue.
Tongue.
And the belly.
Mind.
Anger. Vacho vegam, manasa krodha vegam, jiva vegam, udarapasto vegam. You have to have character also. But not just that, the guru also shows the way. They are able to communicate and train and inspire and mold a disciple. Therefore Prabhupada was the Jagat Guru, because the way he was able not just in his own life to live it, but then communicate and show many others. Therefore, he was unparalleled. So, many of you may not be initiated, you may be looking for your spiritual master, and this is the process. And let me just to be tactical, what are the steps to initiation? The steps to initiation are that first, have relationship with Srila Prabhupada. Before you even look for your living guru, establish an extremely strong relationship with Prabhupada. Understand Prabhupada's books, understand Prabhupada's life, understand Prabhupada's mission, understand Prabhupada's vision for how to practice Krishna consciousness. Because only when you understand Srila Prabhupada, you will be able to identify your spiritual master. Because your spiritual master will be that person that you look at, who when you look at them, you think, this person is 100% follower of Prabhupada. But how you will know that if you don't know Prabhupada? Mm. Right? So the first thing is, sometimes people come into the movement and they're like, who's my guru, who's my guru, who's my guru? Well, first, establish your relationship with Prabhupada. Mm. Then other things will come. Second thing is, become qualified. Before even trying to identify who is my spiritual master, first develop your own qualification as a disciple. One devotee here said, I'm in anxiety, I don't know, like it's been so many years and I don't know who my guru is. And I said, like, how many rounds are you chanting? He's like, 3. I'm like, you know, what's the point? You have to qualify yourself first. The guru, you don't actually find your guru. Did you know that? You don't find your guru. Your guru finds you. You try, but your guru ultimately finds you. And why will the guru find you? Because you're a receptive. You're a qualified candidate. So therefore you have to become qualified. And then what you do is you hear from the guru. And I'm going to put in brackets, serve and associate. If you can get the opportunity to serve and associate with the spiritual masters, it's a very good thing. But the main important thing is you need to hear. Because there will be someone who, when you hear their instructions, when you hear their presentation of Krishna consciousness, it will inspire you over and above others. There will be someone who naturally moves your heart, someone who naturally gives you inspiration. And then the next thing you do is you act in the relationship. And so you develop a relationship with the guru, and there is a period of testing. When you test, you're not so much testing whether the guru is qualified or not. What you're testing is your ability to place faith in that person. And the guru will test you. And then there is initiation. Diksha. Diksha is an interesting word. D comes from divyam jnanam. And ksha comes from papa kshamshayam. So when you take diksha or initiation, two things happen. The spiritual master gives you divya jnana, and the second thing is, at the time of initiation, he accepts responsibility for your sinful reactions. I'll just finish this and then I'll open up, yeah?
What's that last word? Sorry, I couldn't read
that. Shankshayam. This comes from a Sanskrit verse. Divyam jnanam yato dadyat kuryat papa shankshayam. Tato dikshayati sa prokta deshikes tattva ko videi. You want me to tell you the reference? Thank God for Vedabase. It's quoted in Madhya 15:108. Okay, it's funny that this verse should come up. I'll read this verse to you. After I've said all of this, yeah, about the importance of the spiritual master, this is what Madhya 15:108 says. One does not have to undergo initiation One simply has to vibrate the holy name with his lips. Thus, even a man in the lowest class can be delivered. So this verse is funny after everything I've said. This verse says you don't even have to have initiation. The holy name is so powerful, it will do it. But shall I tell you the amazing thing? If you read the purport, Prabhupada gives about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. He quotes 16 verses in the purport and he establishes that everyone should take initiation. Because he's saying, yes, the holy name is so powerful, it doesn't rest on anything. But practically for our purpose, we will never be able to chant with that level of purity. And therefore we require initiation and the help. And initiation, so you have to do all of this. You have to do all of this before you get initiated. And then you know what? Initiation, that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. That gives you entrance. And so here Rupa Goswami is telling everyone that you must go on this journey. You must try to get the mercy of a spiritual master. Okay, let me open it up a bit. So,
what are some of the qualifications of a disciple?
Okay, I'll give you another verse. So this comes in 11th canto of the Bhagavatam. Okay, so qualifications of a disciple. Bhagavatam 11:10:6. I won't read the Sanskrit. Okay, you want to know who's a good disciple? Ready? The disciple of the spiritual master should be free from false prestige, never considering himself the doer. The disciple should feel enmity towards no one. The disciple should be active and never lazy. The disciple should give up all proprietorship over objects of the senses, including wife, children, home and society. The disciple should be endowed with feelings of loving friendship toward the guru and should never become deviated or bewildered. The disciple should always desire advancement in spiritual understanding. The disciple should not envy anyone, and the disciple should always avoid useless conversation. There you go. Good luck. These are the qualities of a disciple. So you see, this is the point. Sometimes, you know, people say, how do I know? Who is a pure devotee? No one's like Prabhupada. No one's, you know, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, even if Prabhupada was your spiritual master, the point is, what's your qualification as a disciple? So sometimes we put so much emphasis on who's the pure devotee. But where's the pure disciple? You see? We must focus on ourselves. And therefore, it's a very good question. And if you focus on yourself, Krishna will reveal and the Guru will find you. But we have to work on the quality of our own. It's not a small thing to be initiated. You know, Kadambakanana Maharaj, he got initiated and then obviously his first Guru left. And then later on, he wanted to take re-initiation from Jayadvaita Swami. So before Jayadvaita Swami initiated him, once they were in a room, and Jayadvaita Swami looked at him and said, as good as God. Are you ready? Because that's, you know, Shakshad Hari Tvain Nasamasta Sastre. All the scriptures say between the Guru and the God, there's no difference. In other words, as a disciple, do you have that level of trust and faith to say, I accept this person as the mouthpiece of God? It's not a small thing. So we know that the Guru is not God, but we accept the Guru as good as God. So how? It takes time to establish that kind of relationship. So there's a lot of work to do on our side. That's what I'm saying. Is that okay?
In that verse you just mentioned, from the 11th canto, it mentions that the disciple should be endowed with feelings of loving friendship towards the spiritual master. But I've heard that there should the feeling towards the spiritual master should always be awe and reverence, even when we reach the spiritual world. There's always that awe and reverence. With Krishna, it can be like different types, but the spiritual master is always that.
The Sanskrit word Saurida, right?
Yeah.
So what's the actual, we translate Saurida or Suridam as friend. But what does the word Surid actually mean etymologically? Rid means the heart. And Su means very good. So it literally means one who's wishing well for you from within their heart. That's what a friend is. Basically a well-wisher. So if you wanted a more kind of accurate or etymologically accurate translation of Sauridam or Surid, it would be well-wisher. So one should look at the Guru and think, the Guru is my well-wisher. I don't need to be scared of my Guru. That's the point. Why would you be scared of your Guru? He's a friend. He's wishing you well. That doesn't mean you don't have respect. But there's an intimacy there as well. You see, also with the Guru, there's a balance between respect and intimacy. If there's too much intimacy, you become familiar and you'll take the Guru to become an ordinary person. And if there's too much respect and no intimacy, it will become so formal that there's not an exchange of the heart. Therefore, in Sanskrit, we call this Vishrambena and Gauravena. There needs to be respect, and at the same time, there needs to be intimacy. And I think that's... Is that okay? Anything else on spiritual master before I go ahead? Okay, yeah, Jack.
First we need to accept master as a siksha, and then even potentially becomes diksha. That's how it works.
Okay, yeah. You have another part to the question? Or?
Is it that or something else? Because this is how I understand it.
Yes. Generally, you will hear from a spiritual master, you will get shiksha from them, and then their shiksha will inspire you to then take diksha from them. So generally, the person who is whose instructions are inspiring you becomes your diksha guru. But there is two types of shiksha. There is... when we talk about shiksha, there is like general shiksha, like in classes. And then there is specific shiksha, which means in terms of advice, can we say life advice? Okay? So Srila Prabhupada is always our shiksha guru in the sense that we're always hearing from him, classes. But we don't get specific life advice. I mean, Prabhupada is not in front of us in that way to give us, right? So, say for example, like you hear Radhana Swami's classes, for example. Practically, most people will never get to speak to him. He may not even know you personally. But by hearing his classes, you get a lot of inspiration. Then he's your shiksha. Getting shiksha from him naturally leads to taking diksha from him, even though you may not get life advice from him. But later on, when you take diksha from him, you will also need other shiksha gurus in your life who give you life advice. Does that make sense? So therefore, here we're talking about diksha gurus, but diksha plus shiksha is very important. Both are required. Therefore, sometimes even if you look in the back of the Bhagavad Gita and look at the parampara, it's not a diksha line. It's a shiksha line. Because sometimes you may get initiated by someone, but the person who's training you up and giving you and guiding your life is more prominent in your life sometimes. For example, Gopal Bhatta Goswami took initiation But his shiksha was from Jiva Goswami. Oh no, sorry, what am I saying? Srinivasacharya took initiation from Gopal Bhatta, but Srinivasacharya's shiksha guru was Jiva Goswami. Shyamananda Pandit took initiation from Hridaya Chaitanya, but his shiksha was Jiva Goswami. Narottam Das Thakur took initiation from Lokanath Das Goswami, but Jiva Goswami was a shiksha guru. So, both are required. Does that make sense?
Yes, I understand, but in this case, like, why does the is not the siksha, the diksha as well, because it's him following you and that you take advice.
So, but in the example I gave you, say for example, Radhanath Maharaj is your siksha guru, you're listening to his classes, you become inspired. One day you take initiation from Radhanath Swami, mm-hmm. but the likelihood is that you will never speak to him. So you will also need other shiksha gurus who are giving you this. So Radhanath Swami was your shiksha guru, he became your diksha guru, but now he's become your diksha guru, you still require more shiksha gurus to solidify that relationship. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see. Yes, thank you.
Can I add something on this?
Yeah.
I heard from another marketing class, he talked about it, that it's important that they will be in the same line, the shiksha and the diksha, they speak about the same essence or... Same kind of attitude.
Yes, very good. Yeah. There is a Sanskrit word, it's called sajatiya. Sajatiya means like-minded. So, the Diksha Guru and the Shiksha Guru should be sajatiya. They should be on the same wavelength so that their instructions naturally go together. Mm-hmm. You see, many in Vaishnavism, this is full of personalism. There could be five gurus, and they are all dedicated devotees, pure devotees, servants of Prabhupada, but they can all have their own mood. Therefore, you have to find sajatiya, a like-minded. Good point. Yeah.
You know, in your point three where it says here, you say it's so that we can do with, like, regardless of who it is. So in terms of service and association, we may not be able to serve and associate personally with Diksha Guru.
Yeah, therefore I put it in brackets. I said if it's available and you have the opportunity, you should do it.
So my question is that, can that also relate to Shiksha Gurus, serving and associating?
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely, same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And sorry, one thing I should have clarified, that it's not like one, then two, then three. Okay, I'm on step number four now, Prabhu's. You can do these things simultaneously, yeah? So you can be developing your relationship with Prabhupada at the same time, raising your rounds, and at the same time hearing from devotees. But the point is, unless you do all of these things before the day of initiation, you may take initiation, but it may not be so substantial. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Can asking questions also be considered to serve?
Yeah, that's coming. Yeah, it's coming. Your questions are also part of it. Yeah.
I was reading in Krishna book that the Diksha Guru is the initiated spiritual master.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your Shiksha Gurus, and traditionally you mentioned, like, your Shiksha Gurus who actually give you the instructions, who actually give you the guidance. So I'm wondering, what is the purpose of having a Diksha Guru? Is it just to kind of, that's the person who, like, delivers you to the spiritual world or something like that? What is the purpose of your, if you're getting that guidance from the Diksha Gurus? And oftentimes we hear that, like, Diksha Gurus are as important or sometimes more important than your Diksha, like that. Sometimes you
say, yeah, so say for example, I'm a bhakta, say for example, and I've got senior devotees who are guiding me. Very sannyasis that are guiding me. What's the need for initiation? I'm already getting guidance. I'm fulfilling. They know the way, they go the way, they show the way. It's still important for a few reasons. Diksha, it does a few things. It formalizes vows. And that's a powerful thing, yeah? It's like Prabhupada said, you take a vow in front of the fire, in front of the Vaishnavas, in front of the deities, in front of the Guru, and there's a certain impression that event makes in your consciousness of commitment. Why do we have a marriage ceremony? It's the same thing if you don't, right? But it's a commitment. Yeah? Why? So it's a samskara. And samskaras, the samskara literally means an impression. Not just that, diksha is not just connecting to a person, but it's about connecting to a parampara. So when you take initiation, you're not just connecting to your guru, but you're connecting to a whole lineage. You know, like even in Vedic culture they say, when a boy and girl marry, they're not just marrying the other person, they're marrying a whole family. That may not be good news, but in spiritual life, it's good news because you're now connected, you have a relationship. Prabhupada said, my grandfather is more merciful than the father. So Prabhupada looked at his disciples and he said, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur will be very merciful to you. That means just by getting initiation from Prabhupada, Bhakti Siddhanta has become your grandfather. So there's a mercy, and that connects to the third point of Diksha, which is, it's a mercy flow. Yes, you'll get mercy even if you're not initiated, but when you are formally part of the family, that it makes a difference.
Talk something else. Yeah.
I have a question about the testing of the guru.
Mm-hmm.
If for example for me it's necessary to act in my conditioning on some bodily platform, is it also important for me to look on how spiritual master actually behaves with the matter and how actually not just spiritual but also physical kind of like these aspects, like how he eats, what he's doing, what services he's preferring, and if it's really like important, because
as in if your personalities match like that.
Yeah.
Another aspect when looking for a spiritual master is, I already mentioned here, sajatiya. Another word is snigdasya. And another word is ashraya. This actually comes from Rupa Goswami as well. So he says you should look for someone who's like-minded. Not just that, someone who you have intimacy and trust with, and not just that, someone who has spiritual advancement. So the spirit, you know, because if we, this is like a general criteria, like who knows the way, goes the way, and can show the way. Well, there could be many, right? So then, once they've passed this, then we have to look at this, which is more personal. Okay, here are like 20 ISKCON gurus who all follow this. So then I have to look, which of these 20 gurus do I naturally connect with, who I can relate to, who I can understand, you know, who inspire faith and trust in me, whose ways of dealing are something that I can resonate with. And as we become more and more purified, what will happen is that the relationship will become more and more spiritualized. So we won't look at those things. It will go beyond all of that. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, it's necessary because you need to be able to connect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
On this point on diksha and shiksha that you mentioned, so why is there a... Why does it have to be different? Why does there need to be two of your diksha? It
doesn't need to be. In Vedic culture, diksha and shiksha was generally just one. In Vedic culture, you'd go to a gurukul at 5 years old,
mm-hmm.
and the guru would actually be a grihastha with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would observe you for 20 years. They would know you inside out. And you'd have such love for them because they basically brought you up and taught you everything. And they would be your guru, they would maybe have like 20, 30 disciples in the village, and that was it, your whole life. Done, finished, job done. So in Vedic culture there was no need, but now it's different. You have a Diksha Guru, but how many times do you see your Diksha Guru? So, you know, ISKCON is a worldwide society and we are big communities, we're all moving. How do we find that ongoing? Yeah. So therefore we need multiple avenues of support like that. Yes,
I see. I think something I didn't get, but like it's only like very specific people, devotees who are recognized as Diksha. So not so many.
In ISKCON, you mean?
Yeah, in general.
In ISKCON, yeah. The GBC, I mean, now we're going into the specifics of ISKCON. It's okay. But the GBC have to authorize someone to be a guru. So I think in ISKCON now there are 100 initiating spiritual masters.
Okay.
Anyway, that whole thing is under debate as well. But yeah,
it makes sense now why the siksha cannot necessarily be your diksha.
Yeah, because in ISKCON a siksha guru may not be authorized to give diksha. Exactly. Yeah. Yes,
it might not be very relevant, but in terms of what you said about purity, in terms of chanting, what level of purity are we talking? Is it in terms of our those base pleasures and things that we seek, are we not quite qualified to just be able to chant the name?
The purity, you're saying what purity before you're ready for initiation?
Or more the fact that when you brought the Veda up, it said you, since one can achieve that level purely by chanting.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah.
Then it means when one is chanting without any of the offense, you know, in the morning, if you remember,
yeah.
We recite the 10 offenses.
Do, yeah.
So, you know, not to be inattentive, not to blaspheme others, you know, all of those things. So if one chants offenselessly, and in a positive sense, one chants with actual absorption, remembrance of Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Then the holy name, from the holy name will provide everything you need. But when we're not chanting purely, we require other sources of inspiration, guidance and purification so that we can refine our practice of chanting. And that's where, you know, the spiritual master is essential.
Comes in. Okay.
Right.
Okay, absolutely.
Yeah. And what will happen is that the spiritual master will also deal with the disciple differently. Everyone has a different relationship with their spiritual master. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he gives three examples. He gives the example of a bird. He gives the example of a tortoise. Oh, sorry. A fish. And he gives the example of a tortoise. So he says, some gurus are like birds. Have you ever seen like a bird with little like chickens in the nest? Like they're running out, they're getting the food, they're bringing it back, they're like hand feeding, like that. So that, some spiritual masters are extremely involved in like directly nourishing the disciple, like hand feeding almost. The fish, have you ever seen a fish? Like underwater even, the fish doesn't close its eyes. The eyes of the fish are always open. So Chakravarti Pad says another type of spiritual master, what they do is they may not directly be involved in the guru, disciple's life, but their eyes are always open. They're looking. What's he doing? What's he up to? Is he following? And when need be, then they'll come and say something. So they're not directly engaging, but their eyes are open and they're watching everything. So they're observing. And then he says, some spiritual masters are like a tortoise. You know how a tortoise brings up its offspring?
Is it like lay eggs on the beach and then...
Literally lay the eggs and then just meditate. Just meditate. And just by their meditation, all the things go on. So some spiritual masters are like that. Sometimes people think, I never speak to my spiritual master, he's never written me a letter, I don't have any relationship with him. But some spiritual masters, they may just be meditating on their disciples. And just by the potency of their meditation, the disciple is getting so much strength and instruction like that. So these are different models. There's so much in the literatures about guru-disciple relationship. I mean, it, It's like, thank you. Like, I'll give you another one, yeah? In the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya, it said that there are three grades of disciple. First example, woman and husband. Second example, mind or senses and mind. Third example, consciousness and soul. So he says, or maybe I should say 3, 2, 1. So the third grade disciple is like a woman and a husband. The husband is a volatile analogy, you can't use it in modern politically correct times, you know. But in Vedic culture, the husband would say, do this. And then after the husband would say, do this, the chaste wife would do it. But it requires the husband to say, do this, and then there's some delay, and then the wife does it. Right? That's the third grade disciple. But he says the second grade disciple is like the senses and the mind. Have you noticed? The mind comes up with an idea, and almost with very short delay, the senses are already planning. Right? But there's still a delay, but it's less. It's more kind of more connected. He says the first class disciple and guru is like consciousness and the soul. Can you separate consciousness from the soul? It's almost like the soul and consciousness are two different things, but they're almost like inseparable. So he says the first class disciple and follower of the guru is like that. It's almost like they're so in tune with the guru that even before the guru has to say, they're already like, done it. Yeah, it's like... So one must understand the heart of the guru. Like, you know that story of the guru and disciple on the horse, right? The guru and disciple were on the horse, and then they were going through a village and something fell off the horse. And the disciple carried on riding the horse. And the guru goes, like, what kind of disciple are you? Something fell off the horse. And you didn't think the need to pick it up? And the disciple said, but Guru Maharaj, you didn't tell me. So then the guru says to him, if anything falls off the horse, pick it up. So then in the next village they're going, and then they're riding, and then, you know, the horse does its business. So then the disciple jumps off and he goes, you know, picks it up. The guru goes, no, you idiot, what are you doing? He said, but Guru Maharaj, you said if something falls off, pick it up. The guru said, look, here's a list. If any of these things fall off the horse, pick it up. Okay, so then they're going through the next... and then they go through a bumpy thing, and then the guru falls off the horse. So the disciples are just looking at the pavement. He's like, no, the guru's not on it. He's like, pick me up. He goes, but you're not on the list. You see? So then the guru, this third class disciple, because they don't understand the heart, you see. I don't understand what is the... You see, like we say, Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam. Manobhistam is a beautiful word. It means he understands that... Rupa understood the inner desire of Mahaprabhu. What was his heart? You see? So it's a beautiful thing. Guru-disciple relationship is like... I think of all the relationships you have in spiritual life, the relationship with the guru is the most mystical relationship. Because that relationship is completely based on surrendering your life to Krishna. That's the reason that the guru and disciple became connected. So it's a beautiful opportunity. So these first three principles are all about the spiritual master, serving the spiritual master, accepting initiation from the spiritual master. So it's something that all of us can think about, you know, what am I doing to advance in this aspect of my spiritual life? Because it makes a big difference. It took me I was in the ashram 8 years before I got initiated. So it took me much longer than others. Because for many years I thought, well, I'm going Mangalarti every day. I'm doing everything. I'm going out on Sankirtan. Like, I'm a Prabhupada man. You know, so I'll be fine. Yeah. And if a guru comes, a guru comes. But then later on, at a certain point, I realized that I can only go so far by my own by my own plans. I need someone to guide me. And then after that initiation happened, it really took my spiritual life forward. Still a long way to go. Okay, so before we carry on, does anyone have any last questions on spiritual master or any of these aspects?
Mind to repeat, what was the sense and mind? What is the
analogy? Analogy is that, you see, in the woman or the wife follows the husband, but there's a slight delay. Like the husband says something and then there's a delay and then the wife does it. The senses and mind, the initial, everything begins in the mind, a desire. And then once the desire comes in, it comes through, and then the senses start doing something. So it's the gap between the mind desiring something and the senses fulfilling it is a less of a gap. But the consciousness and the soul, there's almost no gap between them. As soon as there's the soul, there's consciousness. So the first class disciple is like that. They're fully in tune with the Guru. They know the heart of the Guru. Therefore, what does Prabhupada write? If you open your Bhagavatam and you look in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, what does Prabhupada write? The spiritual master lives forever in his instructions and the follower lives with him. When you've understood the heart of the Guru, then you're always living with the Guru. Yeah, because you're inseparable. Yeah.
Just thinking, not a question, but I was thinking like the senses and mind one is maybe a bit like that versus the consciousness and soul example analogy is that consciousness and soul, that level is like the disciple senses what the guru wants. They can see, they understand, so they're so connected and tuned. Like so, whereas senses and mind that second level is like they kind of have to wait for the spiritual one to say, I want this, and then they're on it.
Yeah.
Like the senses being triggered by the mind.
Yes.
And then, yeah, whereas if you're in tune, they can just...
They don't need to say, you've absorbed their mood. Yeah, right.
I want to ask it, maybe it's a bit more of a personal question, but after taking initiation, I've heard some people describe it as like a boost, a spiritual boost. They felt they had like blessings of the parampara, like pushing, encouraging them forward or something.
Yeah.
Did you kind of feel something or have some sort of feeling like this is... some change after or something like that after taking initiation or sometime after taking initiation?
I mean, the day after initiation you still have to wake up for Mangalarti. you still have to put your hand in your bead bag. In one sense it doesn't change, you know, but in another sense it does change, because now there's a person who's a representative of Krishna. There's a person who's taking responsibility for you and who's clearly extremely accomplished in spiritual life and can take you there. There's a person who can give you a vision for your life which is much greater than you could have come up with yourself. There's a person who's praying for you. There's a person you can go to if you have problems. It makes a huge difference. There's a person who then says something, and even if to you it sounds like impossible, all of a sudden, because they've said it, and because of your relationship with them, of course it's possible. In other words, it's someone who can take you beyond the confines of your own limited perception
and introduce you to the unlimited world of possibility in Krishna consciousness. And so, of course, it's a huge thing. But it depends on how seriously we take it and how much faith we have. There's no point taking initiation if you don't have that faith. Because if you just take initiation out of some social convention, but you don't have faith in the Guru, you won't be able to access the real treasures of that relationship. Yeah. Mm. So. Okay. Alright, so that was a lot on the Guru. Are we ready for a break now? Or no?
Maha served at around 4:40, so it's still an hour.
Alright, so shall we just go through these one by one? Is that how you're doing it, right? Should we read it? Alright, so we've done 1, 2, and 3. Let's just go along and see what else comes up. Okay, so the next fourth principle is following in the footsteps of saintly persons. I'll just read one paragraph. In the Skanda Purana, it is advised that a devotee follow the past acharyas and saintly persons, because by such following, one can achieve the desired results with no chance of lamenting or being baffled in his progress. So as we know, in Krishna consciousness, there are three things. Narottam Das Thakur says, Guru Sadhu Sastra Vakya Chitete Koriya Aikya. That if you want your consciousness to be purified, there's a Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. And all of these things should be together, in line. Now we've already said Shastra is important, because if you don't know Shastra, then you won't know who is Guru. Right? Because Guru has to know Shastra, and it works the other way around as well, that you can't really understand Shastra unless you have a Guru, someone who will teach you. So then someone may say, if you have Guru in your life and if you have Shastra in your life, why do you need sadhus? Why do you need to follow in the footsteps of saintly persons? What would be your answer? If you have Guru and Shastra, it's enough. Why do you need sadhus? What do sadhus bring to the table that Guru and Shastra doesn't bring?
Like association, like-minded people, or people who are also practicing at the same level as, like peer association.
Yeah, there may be a certain peers or friends or others that are saintly persons that help you in a way that the Guru may not necessarily connect with you in that way. Yeah, very good. What else?
Sadhu Sangha.
Yes, because the whole process, when we look at the 64 items of devotional service, Guru introduces you to the 64 or the other 61 items. But if you look at all of those items, they're all done in the association of others. If you look at all, like for example, going to the dham, you have to go with devotees. You have to go with sadhus, otherwise you won't see anything. Chanting the holy name. But if there's no sadhus around, who are you going to chant with? Right? Reading the Bhagavatam. But if there's no one to converse and discuss the Bhagavatam with, how are you going to do it? Serving the deity. Serving the deity is not a one-person job. Serving the deity is done as a community with other saintly people. So even if you look at Pancha Anga Bhakti, or the five potent forms of devotional service, it's all done in association with sadhus. So sadhus means presently living saintly people, and sadhus also means the great saints of the past. And therefore, it's also important, because sadhu also means the previous teachers who can help you understand things and give you mercy. So that's why here it's saying that sadhu marg anugamanam, which means following in the footsteps of the saintly persons, like that. And sadhu means someone who is following guru and shastra. So here Prabhupada gives the example of Buddha. Buddha rejected the Vedas, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Buddha taught what? Ahimsa. And he said, forget all the Vedas, forget all the sacrifices that are mentioned, just be non-violent. But who is Buddha? Keshava Drita Buddha Sharira Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Buddha is Krishna. But here Prabhupada says, Buddha is Krishna, but because Buddha rejected the Shastra, we don't even follow Buddha. Think like, but Buddha's Krishna. Yeah, Buddha may be Krishna, but Buddha didn't follow the Shastra, therefore we don't follow Buddha. Like that. I mean, we still, of course, we respect and we honor and we understand why Buddha came, but we don't necessarily follow the teachings of the Buddha, because the teachings of the Buddha were for a certain type of place, at a certain time, for a certain purpose. And so this is how you know who is a sadhu. A sadhu is one who follows guru, parampara and shastra. Yeah, make sense? Okay, then fifth principle, inquiring about eternal religious principles. So yeah, someone asked, questioning. Someone said that, right? Yeah, so here it is. Asking questions. Inquiring about, that's also an anga of devotional service. Asking questions is a devotional service. If questions are articulated for the benefit and for the purpose of spiritual advancement. And therefore we should have questions. Generally, if we're in a class but questions are not coming to the mind, then generally it means we're not really engaging with the subject matter in a deep way. Either you're just accepting it on face value, and you're not really thinking deeply about it. And even if you think deeply about it and you're convinced and it's clear to you, still you'll have questions because you will be so eager that you want to know more about it. You see? So questions signify two things. One, that you're thinking about something and that you need to clear up doubts. Or two, that you've understood something, become inspired about it and want to know more about it. In either case, you will have questions. Therefore, there used to be one American sannyasi used to come here, and at the end of the class, if no one had any question, he'd be like, no question, no relationship. You have no relationship. Jesus said that, yeah. He said, no question, no relationship. It means there's no connection, there's no transmission, there's no, because, you know, this is, this must be there. Oh, he's got a question.
You see, I think it's some Ramoni Maharaj who said, if at the end of the class you don't have questions or realizations, that means you were not listening to you.
Yeah. Because someone once came to me and said, yeah, I don't have questions because it all makes sense to me. But even if it all makes sense to you, if it actually makes sense to you, you'll be so inspired about it that you'll have a question which will help to bring out more. It's funny, when you look at the Bhagavatam, Sukadev Goswami begins speaking in the second canto, right? Because the first canto is just like a preface. And Parikshit asks him a question. Parikshit is like, what's the duty of someone who's about to die? And what's the duty of all people in all circumstances? So Sukadev Goswami, he's just like a mastermind. He just like, boom, 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 boom. He just answers it in like one chapter. And then Parikshit is like, oh my God, like he's answered all the questions. Like, oh my God, like, so you know what Parikshit does? He he quickly starts thinking of more questions to ask, because he's like, I've asked this question, he's answered it, and if I don't keep him talking, he's just going to move and he's just going to walk on. He's probably going to go somewhere else. But this association is like, wow, this is like, when are you going to get a chance like this to associate? So he's like, okay, let's ask questions. Let's draw out the nectar. Let's see what more we can discover. Right? So that's pretty... He understood everything. It's not that he didn't. He understood it. But he was still had questions because he was eager to draw out more information about the subject matter. So yeah, if there's no question, there's no relationship. So there should be questions. No pressure. Yeah? Okay, next one. Being prepared to give up everything material for Krishna's satisfaction. In the Padma Purana it is stated, for one who has given up his material sense enjoyment and accepted the principles of devotional service, the opulence of Vishnu Loka, the kingdom of God, is awaiting. So yeah, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he writes a book called Saranagati. And Saranagati is a book of songs. And Saranagati means surrender. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his opening song, he explains what are the six items of surrender. Anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya varjanam rakshishyati divishvasho gotritve vananam tatha atmanikshepakarpanye sadvida saranagati. So he says that surrender has six limbs, six things you should do. But the first two things, anukulyasya sankalpa, accepting what is favorable. And the second one, pratikulyasya varjanam, giving up what is unfavorable. So here, Rupa Goswami is explaining that there are many things you should do in spiritual life, but there are many things that you should give up. You see, like, I think it was Ashtavakra Muni once, he was giving a class and someone in the audience asked, what is the nature of illusion? And he got up, I don't think it was Ashtavakra Muni, someone else, but the sage got up and he ran into the courtyard and he saw a tree and he went up to the tree and he began holding it like that, saying, let me go, let me go, let me go, shouting. He says, this is the nature of illusion. That we're saying, we're going in front of Krishna every day, saying, I want to go to the spiritual world, I want to get out of all this misery. But then we're holding on to the material world. We're holding on to the things that give us misery. We're unable to let go of the very things that cause our entanglement in this world. And so here Rupa Goswami says, one of the angas of bhakti is to be prepared. Let it go. If it's not helping you, let it go. It's not so easy to let go. There may be relationships which are not beneficial for us. We've got to learn to let it go. There may be habits which are not good for us. We need to be able to let it go. Then someone may say, but it's so hard, I'm trying to let it go, I can't let it go. Therefore, we have to work on that, take help. Because if your hands are full, you see, if your hands are full, then there's no space for Krishna to give you prema, love. First you have to pull everything else down and come with empty hands. And then Krishna can give you prema. Yeah? Okay, next one. Residing in a sacred place. So, okay, I'll just read the first paragraph. In the Skanda Purana, it is also said that for a person who has lived in Dwaraka for for 6 months, for 1 month, or even for 1 fortnight, there is a waiting elevation to the Vaikuntha Lokas, and all the profits of Sarupya Mukti, the privilege of having the same four-handed bodily features as Narayan. In Brahma Purana it is said, the transcendental significance of Purushottam Kshetra, which is 80 square mile field of Lord Jagannath, cannot be properly described. Even the demigods from the higher planetary system see the inhabitants of this Jagannath Puri as having exactly the same bodily features possessed by one in Vaikuntha. That is, the demigods see the inhabitants of Jagannath Puri as being four-handed. That's amazing, huh? That's amazing, huh? The demigods come down and they look in Jagannath Puri and they're seeing everyone, you know. And they're seeing everyone in a four-handed form because they're seeing that ultimately this is their destiny. They're all residents of the spiritual world. I think I told you last time, right? How you identify in Jagannath Puri the demigods. If you ever go to Jagannath Puri temple and you see someone who A, their feet doesn't touch the ground, B, they cast no shadow, or three, what's the third one?
They don't blink their eyes,
that's it. Yes. Then you can understand it. This looks like just some Bengali person or some Orissa lady or something. But it's a demigod. Demigods are coming. Swarga Dwar is a portal through which the demigods come into Jagannath Puri to take darshan. Yeah.
Have you ever seen
a demigod
in Jagannath Puri?
Holy places are, here is talking about sacred places. Sacred places are incredibly important. In Sanskrit, a sacred place, it's not so good. A Sanskrit place is known as a tirtha. Anyone know what tirtha means?
Bridge.
Yeah. Heard me say it many times. Bridge, crossing place, portal. So essentially a tirtha is like an access point to the spiritual world. So there are earthly tirthas, there are envisioned tirthas, and there are individual tirthas. Individual. An earthly tirtha is like what we're talking about here, Dwarka, Jagannath Puri, Vrindavan, Haridwar. An envisioned tirtha is like the manna. This is also considered a tirtha because it's a community in which Krishna is at the center. Therefore, Prabhupada called his temples New Vrindavan, New Mayapur, New Dwaraka. And then the individual is also a tirtha. Prabhupada was like a walking place of pilgrimage because Krishna was in his heart. Wherever he went, he made it into a tirtha. So a tirtha means a holy place. Etymologically, it means a bridge, a crossing place, or a portal. And the idea is that if you contact any of these types of tirthas, then it qualifies you to go to Goloka, which is the spiritual world. Because these are portals to get there. Therefore, it's said that by spending time in a holy dham, a sacred place, one can actually begin to access the spiritual world in that way.
Sorry, what was an individual?
Individual tirtha means a pure devotee. Vidura, he leaves the palace after being insulted by Duryodhan. And then after a pilgrimage, he comes back, and the day he arrives back in Hastinapur, then Yudhisthira invites him in and he says a beautiful verse. Bhavadvida bhagavata stirta bhuta svayam vibhu tirthi kurvanti tirthani svantasena gadavrita. He says, Vidura, you are just like a walking place of pilgrimage. You're like a walking Tirtha because you carry the Lord within your heart. Whichever place you visit, that place becomes a Tirtha. And so that's the effect of saintly people.
I think Prabhupada mentioned, I don't remember if it, in this purpose that the spirit, that the holy places are always because of the spiritual...
Because of the people who come there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They actually are what make, yes.
Mm.
It's said that, like, say for example, someone may go to a holy place, all the people come there and they deposit their sinful reactions, for example, in the Ganga.
Yeah.
And then what happens is the saintly people, the sadhus, they come there and simply by them bathing, they release that burden of the saintly, the sins. And Bhagavatam says, Yatirta buddhi shalile nakar hichit janeshva bigyeshu sa eva gokhala. You are said to have the mentality of an ass. If you go to a holy place, but you simply bathe in a river or see a temple or take a darshan, but you don't speak to the holy people that are there, then you miss the whole point. Because the whole point of going to a holy place is to speak to holy people, because they can give you the knowledge.
I heard from someone else says, to get a four-handed body like that, it was got to do with our constitutional position or like our consciousness. But if going to the holy place and staying there for some time,
you get that.
Because of the tirtha, like we get that. It's possible to get that.
Yeah, of course these four-handed forms are like, there's different, you know, like there are some forms in the spiritual world that spiritual bodies that individuals can have that transform, you know, so like they have their body and then it can transform into a forearm form, or you know, like things like that can also happen, you know. These are different boons that are given, different elements of spiritual perfection that are there. Ultimately, what you're saying is right, that each of us have our own constitutional position in the spiritual world. And sometimes, you know, by dint of different spiritual practices, we may get certain boons. But our constitution stays the same. All right, next one. Accepting only what is necessary. One should not accept more than necessary if he is serious about discharging devotional service. So then the natural question there would be, when does necessary become excessive?
When we have two lokas.
When we have?
Two lokas.
When we have two lokas, yeah. And why is two lokas excessive? How do you know?
Because some of the other people can live with one loka.
That's a good point. It's encroaching upon others.
No, I mean, like, it's possible to live with one loka. So one loka is excessive.
Yeah, but how? But we need something more practical. Okay, but someone may... How do you know that you're going above what is necessary? Someone may say, I need two lokas. That's my need.
So maybe the amount of service that I'm doing is not in line with the amount of things that I possess.
Okay. So it's matching your lifestyle. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
So also entails more agitation. It's excessive.
Causes agitation or anxiety.
Yeah.
What else?
Where do you actually use those things?
Utilization of those things. Otherwise, you're just hoarding.
Yeah. More attachments.
You're
It becomes excessive when it's when you're becoming attached to it. Anything else?
I mean, maybe off topic. I read it in Patanjali Sutra, and he said that the less things we have, the more clear is our past and future. Like, so maybe if we are bewildered, where we're going, but that's also kind
of... Yeah, it clouds consciousness. Fuels desires. So like this, there are many ways in which you can understand whether there's something, simplicity is... Yeah, it's a very beautiful thing. If you can be simple on a physical level, on an emotional, mental level, on a spiritual level, it creates a very powerful foundation for spiritual life. Yeah.
If it starts to appeal to material desires, could that be excessive, considered?
Yeah, it appeals to material, you mean it kind of incites more material
desires?
Yeah,
incites more, yeah.
Insights, desires, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So we should try and live within our means. Keep it simple. Yeah. Okay, next one. Yeah. Observing fasting on Ekadashi. So, of course, we know there are two purposes of Ekadashi. One purpose is that it helps you to control your mind and senses by limiting your food intake. I mean, what we eat is a huge thing. It's like, if you can control your eating, I mean, you already discussed that in NOI, that if you can control the tongue, the belly, and because they're all in a line, right? So if you control that, then everything else will automatically become controlled. So there's a sense in which that control of the mind and senses is very powerful. And the second thing is that that control of the mind and senses is not an end in and of itself. That control of the mind and senses is for the purpose of then ultimately giving oneself to Krishna, like that, coming closer to Krishna. Therefore, Ekadashi, the one is called Ekadashi, but another word is Upavas. Some of you may be familiar with this word. Ekadashi literally means the 11th day, right, on the lunar calendar. But the synonym is Upavas. Upa means, what does Upa mean?
Water.
Upanishad,
water.
Upananda, Upendra,
Nia.
No,
water.
Nia, Nia. Upanishad means to sit near the Guru. Upendra is a name for the brother of Indra, because it means near Indra. Upavas, so this means Nia, and Vas, what does Vas mean? Vanavas.
Vasudev,
yeah, Vasudev. Ram went into Vanvas. What does Van mean?
Forest.
Forest. So if I say Ram went into Vanavas,
where he lives.
He went to live, reside in the forest. So Vas means where you reside, or where you live. So the literal etymology of Upavas or Ekadashi means the day where you live close to the Supreme Lord. In other words, you increase your hearing, chanting, like that. And then you can do different types of Upavas. There is like Nirjal. Right? That's coming up soon, right? 10th of June, I think,
yeah.
Right? On that day, you don't even have jal, which means water. Or you can do sajal. Sajal means only water. Or you can do safal.
only fruits. I like that anyway, there's so many. So everyone takes their own vow, and then you just do that, like, according to your capacity. So Ekadashi, it's very powerful. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he used to, you know what he used to do on every Ekadashi? He used to review the last 2 weeks of his life and review how he did and set goals for the next 2 weeks. So like Ekadashi was like his review time of his life and his service to Krishna like that. So Ekadashi, fasting. Is it time for Maha?
Yeah.
It's time now, huh?
Yes.
What's the time exactly?
4:40.
What time do you usually go until?
Usually it's like 2.5 hour session.
So you go to 5:30 usually, is it?
Yeah, but usually we start at 3:30 and go to 6. But
oh.
Yeah.
So 3:30 and go to 6. Okay, so do you want to take a 10-minute break? And then we can.
Yeah.
Okay, you take 15 minutes break, isn't it? It's good. And then, so what then time will everyone come back?
4:55.
And then can we finish at 5:15? Just because I've got to go for a program at 6.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then we'll begin at 4:55 and then we'll do 20 minutes. Yeah, is that okay?
Thank you.
Jai.